Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Welcome to The Money Show, proudly brought to you by APSA Corporate and Investment Banking, winner of the 2019 Bonds, Loans and Sukuk Award for Corporate Debt Deal of the Year. That's African Asset. APSA is a registered FSP. We're waiting for Dondo Mohojane. He is the Director General in the National Treasury. We'll talk to him about Team SA going off to Davos, jetting off on Sunday to get there on Monday for the events to happen on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday and half of Friday. And then everybody jets back home again. They won't be going on SAA. Whether SAA will still be flying by next week is a matter of some concern. So we'll pick up on that as well with the Director General in the DG. Some 2 billion rand expected to flow from the National Treasury to SAA. Otherwise, warns SAA, it may not be airborne next week. It's a deep concern. But the good news story today, if you are somebody with debt, and let's face it, most of us do have debt, we'd like it to be a lot cheaper. The Reserve Bank finally acquiescing and cutting interest rates by 25 basis points, a quarter of 1%. We'll talk to Isa Mahlangu about that in just a second. And also this evening, we've got Warren Ingram back in the hot seat. Pavlo Fatidis is back. He's going to be talking about confidence. Remember confidence? It hasn't been around for a while, but why you do need to have confidence and optimism, because by the very nature of small business people, you have to be an optimist. Otherwise, you're going to do absolutely nothing. You're going to be stunned into being incapable of actually growing your small business into something less small. And then Warren Ingram this evening on the cost of investing. But one investment house has come out with a plan to have a fixed rate, a fixed cost, and it's a total cost. Finally, somebody's figured out a way to price the cost of investing in a way that you could actually understand it. All of that tonight on The Money Show.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702. For the curious.
By breakfast time tomorrow, money will be cheaper. The Reserve Bank implementing a long overdue surprise interest rate cut in a dying economy, cutting the repo rate by 25 basis points to 6.25%. So that means that the prime rate is reduced to 9.75. It's long overdue. It really is. Isa Mhlanga is the chief economist at Alexander Forbes. I would have thought that the risks to the economy, the risks to the outlook, were far higher today than they perhaps were in November, when this rate cut should have happened, Isa. What forced the Reserve Bank's hand?
I think there are a couple of factors that contributed to the cut in interest rate. Globally, I think economic growth is slower, but we also have reduced tensions between the US and Iran, which means oil prices are not expected to continue to increase. But also, if you look in the UK, we have Brexit that seems to be going closer and closer to certainty, which means that uncertainty that was in the system globally has reduced. But locally, I think a number of reasons as well. If you look at inflation, it has been at 4.5% or below for the past 12 consecutive months, which means we don't have any inflation problems for now. But also, this is indicated in the subs forecast, which have been slashed for 2020, for 2021, much lower than what the sub expected in November last year. So there are a number of reasons that supported a cut, which if you, compared to what would not have supported a cut, which is only the fiscal risk and a credit rating downgrade. And simply the sub can't do much there.
So much of what the reasoning that was put forward today is reasoning that could have been logically argued in November last year, could have certainly been argued in September last year, when we could have had be far further ahead in terms of a rate cutting cycle.
But potentially not, because at that time, at least if we follow the World Bank's forecast, they expected 1.4% economic growth for 2020, which means growth was expected to improve. Come January, they slashed that growth to 0.9. So expectations for growth has been reduced this month relative to where we were last year, September or even November. So the growth prospects have been deemed largely driven by the inability of Eskom to provide electricity to South African corporates.
Yeah, but the Reserve Bank has long told us that its job is not to manage the economy. Its job is to manage the value of the rand. Its job is to manage inflation expectations. Those are its primary tasks. We seem to be getting a message from the Reserve Bank that it feels a need to intervene in the economy. We're not getting the structural changes that the Reserve Bank governor always refers to, that those that we need in order to get sustained economic growth. Does the Reserve Bank governor feel obliged now to start acting?
I think the Reserve Bank is always cares about economic growth. It's not an explicit target for growth, but they do inflation targeting to make sure that prices are stable in the interest of balanced and sustainable growth. And a less than 1% economic growth is just not sustainable. Just think about what level of economic growth do we require for us to stabilize our debt. We need 2.6% upwards sustainably. And if you're growing it less than 1%, we're going to 1.9% in 2022. It means we are nowhere close to that. And we are facing an economic crisis. Just to illustrate, the generation of the fee-free education of 2018 finishes their first degree this year. And they'll be waiting for jobs. Is the economy ready for those with those jobs?
No, it's not. It's not. Companies are cutting back everywhere. The public sector is looking to cut back in many respects as well. We're facing brutal, brutal realities. Final question. Is this the first of several rate cuts this year? The first of two rate cuts this year? What is your assessment?
Potentially the first of two, but the Reserve Bank is likely to wait a bit and see what happens in the budget and what Moody's is going to do and the reaction of financial markets and the economy after that. But I think for me, the bottom line is this. Yes, the Reserve Bank is cut, but that's not where growth is going to come from. Growth is going to come from structural economic reforms. So now it is in the hands of government to actually, you know, implement the structural reforms that are required to lift economic growth. We cannot really expect the SARB to do the heavy lifting. In any case, we need a minimum of a 100 basis point cuts in interest rates to improve economic growth by 0.5%, which is far from being possible to be done.
Isa, thank you very much indeed. Isa Mhlanga is the Chief Economist at Alexander Forbes. To Dono Mohajane now, Director General at the National Treasury. Team South Africa gearing up to attend the 50th annual World Economic Forum gathering at Davos in Switzerland. I'm going to be attending next week, broadcasting from there next week with the team. Dono, good evening to you. What story is government taking to Davos this time round?
Look, thank you, Bruce, for having me. We're taking the same story. We open for business. We are determined. We have to attract investments in our country. We have to talk to business, big business in Davos, for them to come in big, big numbers. We remain a very reliable destination for investments. We want to set ourselves in the bottom of the continent to be a springboard for the next growth story, which is Africa, for the world to see, for the world to come and set up office and shop here in South Africa in order to take advantage of this next growth pool, which is Africa as a whole.
Yet, every time we go, we promise we're open for business, and yet it becomes harder and harder to do business in South Africa. The Eskom crisis is just one aspect of it, and South Africa's fiscal situation, you will know better than most, is more vulnerable than it's been in two decades.
Look, we are, you can say that, but look, we know where our challenges are. We are determined, Bruce, to ensure that we take advantage of opportunities that are there to actually address and sort out our challenges. The last speaker on that we interviewed now was speaking about addressing some of the structural challenges. I think it's important we know and we realize that we need to do something on this front, and we cannot falter, we cannot go back to the commitments that we had. At least we know where our challenges are, and we know what will take us to fix our fiscal challenges. And then come the budget, you know, we'll obviously be outlining some of what those structural reforms are, what are those fundamental.
Oh, I hope we haven't lost you, Dondo. Dondo Mohajane is Director General in the National Treasury. The team attending this year, is it being cut back? Is there some level of austerity coming to bear when it comes to Team South Africa attending? I know the President isn't going because he's going to the Africa-UK Investment Summit, and that's probably a better use of his time. But are we sending a smaller team this year? Boom. Tikiso, please try and get hold of Dondo. He did have some issues. He's been on the phone all day, so he's charging his phone in the car as he was talking to us this evening. So hopefully we can get hold of Dondo Mukhajane in just a moment. Otherwise, let's see if we can get hold of him. Dondo, yes. Sorry, the phone line died on us. Are we taking a smaller team to Davos than normal this year as Team South Africa?
Yeah, government delegation is much, much smaller. President Ramaphosa is not going to Davos. Davos will be led by Minister of Finance and Minister of Trade and Industry and Commerce, and Minister Patel, and Minister of Relations. So there's a short team, but government obviously is taking a big delegation. I met some of them this morning. It's important that we recognize that if it's business, it must be real. If it's business that you want to attract, we must counter the whoever's going to be in Davos from various international investors to our own South Africans who believe that you have to put our differences aside, and they are doing that. In the past, Davos offered big opportunities, and we must take advantage of that, Bruce.
And it's about attracting attention. It's about being at the center of the discussion. I mean, the last time I was there was Jacob Zuma's last visit, and it was an unmitigated disaster from a Team South Africa perspective. He had a hissy fit. The Team South Africa was vulnerable. It was just after Ntantandene got fired. We were in a complete and utter shambles. We're in far better shape today in terms of a country and a team that we're taking. What are you hoping to bring back? I know this isn't a place where you go to collect trophies. It's not the Oscars, but what sort of message are you hoping to deliver in order to get the return that you need to get to justify this visit?
There's a session, Bruce, where the country specific dialogue is going to take place, where it's a very focused conversation with 60 global investors, 60 global CEOs, and we are going to be partnering with them in this room. And we want to, you know, obviously we want to open up in terms of our challenges. We cannot go and actually paint a good picture altogether, but we want to be saying to them, we have our challenges. We are politically stable, and we know what our challenges are, and we are prepared, and we've demonstrated that there are some challenges and special reforms that we need to embark on, and we have ticked some of the boxes. We've got the IRP in place. We've got a process in place to actually unlock the spectrum release, and the regulator is very clear in terms of what needs to be done, and we remain a very focused important destination for the rest of Africa. That's the message that you're going to be sending out there with the rest of the delegation from business that's going to be going there.
Is there any development today? We saw Carol Payton's story late last night, and then the Lead in Business Day today about the threat to SAA if it doesn't get 2 billion rand of government promised funding as part of the business rescue process, that SAA could be grounded by Sunday night. Has there been any progress on that today?
Look, we said it before, it's government intention to actually ensure that the jobs are preserved in any way possible. In December, you remember that Minister Pravin Gordhan released a statement at the time where he indicated that government will be contributing 2 billion rand from its own coffers and the lenders will be contributing 2 billion from the coffers. I'm currently, I've just finished a meeting with various the business risk practitioners. We've just finished a business discussion with lender representatives. We continue to be engaged because clearly we have to make sure that we address the challenge at SAA, and I think that there are a bright time, which can be as early as tomorrow. We should be able to confirm what the future is in terms of funding that was committed by government. But government, I can say and confirm, that is committed to ensuring that we meet the obligations that we have set for ourselves without actually letting this airline falter in the way or actually an uncontrolled collapse. Call it that, some people call it that, and that's not our intention. Our intention is to make sure that we meet our obligations as promised, and we will continue to engage with various people who are prepared to actually bridge what essentially is a 2 billion rand facility that we've been talking about.
Look forward to that announcement tomorrow. Dondo Mokgatjani giving a very positive signal this evening that there has been progress today in those discussions between government, the business rescue practitioner, and other parties, whoever those other parties might be, in order to secure the 2 billion rand that SAA needs to carry on limping on until there is a business case and until they're able to resolve the issues at SAA. It was during the holiday period that the business rescue practitioner said, "Oh no, there's a business here. There is definitely a business here that can be rescued." And not all hope is lost on that particular front, which is a piece of good news on this Thursday evening on The Money Show.
The Money Show.
The markets.
Graham Kerner with the Kerner perspective. We had an interest rate cut. It comes through. I think your perspective on this one, Graham, is that it's too little too late. We could have had a lot more, a far more aggressive interest rate cut, and we could have got it earlier.
Yeah, Bruce, I think... And I mean, I'm one of those people who's sort of defended the Reserve Bank in terms of independence. But, you know, we're in a very, very desperate position. You know, whether we grow at 0.4% or 0.8%, as I was saying earlier, you know, it's so far below what we need to actually keep this country going. And the truth is, it almost feels as though the South African economy is approaching stall speed, you know. And, you know, 25 basis points is we're grateful for it, but the reality is it's not actually going to do very much. And I think my perspective is that in November 2018, the SARB decided to, after having cut earlier in 2018, decided to hike interest rates. So my sense is 50 bips would have done a whole lot more than 25. 25 is almost like we just, you know, we're cutting because we feel it's prudent and we'll give you another one maybe in a few months' time. I think 50 would have given... the South African economy a little bit more than you know, what's really just almost a gesture of goodwill, 25 basis points.
And we look then at the growth environment, and we look at the performance of interest rate sensitive shares today. Mm. We should have seen a bounce up in banks. We should have seen a bounce up in retailers. They had their gains yesterday, I suppose, with those mad November sales numbers. But yeah, today there was no positive reaction to what should have been a good piece of news for them.
Yeah, Bruce, I think if you look at it in context, I think just before the governor made his announcement, just before 3 o'clock, the market, I think, was down 0.2% thereabouts. It ended up almost a quarter. So it was a good probably 300-odd point turnaround. So and if you look at some of the banks, for example, they definitely were off the lows of the day, as were a couple of the insurers and the likes of Discovery. But I think you're exactly right. And I think part of it is you had a little bit of bad news flow out of the likes of ShopRite, you know, of course, Clicks. You know, unfortunately, it's in the stratosphere and is obviously quite vulnerable. But I think today, when you look at the market up 0.25%, you have to say the star performers were really the commodity stocks, and particularly the gold and platinum producers. The rest of the market was kind of neither here nor there, which almost was, I think, a reflection of the way the rest of the world was going. And yeah. I think that's a function of the fact that the US in early trade was yet again in record territory. So I think there's a little bit of angst building up that maybe some global markets have run too far.
Possibly. But I mean, what's underpinning our market and did largely for 2019 what helped so much was the platinum price and the platinum group metals prices. Rhodium at $6,000 an ounce, palladium at over $2,100 an ounce, platinum over $1,000. The PGMs, the platinum group metals producers, are the star performers. They really continue to be the lifesavers of the South African market.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's reflected if you look on a 1 year rolling view, you know, the resources index is up 23%, and you look at the equally weighted, you know, the capped is only up 2.2%. That tells you just how divergent that performance was. But Bruce, there was one thing that actually caught my eye, and that was small caps and mid caps actually did better than the broader market. They were up, I think, 0.4 and 0.55% respectively. So that was a little bit encouraging, because maybe those are some of the companies that, you know, where there's quite a big value buildup, and B, I think those are the kinds of companies who might benefit from an improving economy and maybe a little bit of improving consumer confidence.
Yeah, Dan, we look at the loser of the day, big loser of the day, including Sasol. No sooner did it get a little bit of positive news in December and some management changes and some hope that they're finally we're going to get put the ghosts of their ethane cracker to behind them, then there's an explosion and everyone loses confidence in Sasol once again, below $280 today.
Yeah. I don't know how much it's going to hit the operations, but I think it's just more credibility. It's really sad. I mean, the reality of it is that Sasol, if you just look at it on kind of a business as usual basis and you say, well, Lake Charles is not a great asset, but it's going to contribute, it's probably worth 400 Rand. But the question is, what sort of discount do you put on for you know, the incredible missteps over the last 3 or 4 years? And then, you know, just when we think, okay, things are starting to get going, and I think Sasol was, what, 320 just a few days ago, and suddenly you get this news, and you get the feeling that management are just really not in control of that business. And, you know, the new management really has to dig deep and I think has to crack the whip, quite frankly.
I think you're absolutely right. And there's no such thing as bad news when it comes to corporate restructurings. And Telkom's announcement yesterday that it is looking to cut jobs, that was rewarded with a 5% gain in the share price. Department of Communication doesn't like it. The minister wants to go and meet the chief executive and the board and go and have a chat about not cutting jobs. But the brutal reality is, until we get growth in this economy, companies like Telkom are doomed.
Bruce, I had an epiphany earlier today where I was sort of thinking it's very easy for politicians and bureaucrats to theorize about job cuts and, you know, the fact that, you know, let policy take its course and we'll decide when we're good and ready. But the reality is those guys, with all due respect, are completely insulated from the broader economy. You look at Massmart, you know, Dion Wyatt is, let's be honest, the mess game is also just sort of, it's like an Achilles heel for them. You look at Telkom, they're saying, well, you know, their core business model is dying. You can understand why companies are looking to cut costs. So I think the point behind all of this is, you know, Tito Mboweni has been almost crucified for having some firm views on the fact that, you know, there were policy decisions or policies were adopted at you know, in 2018 that frankly were nonsensical. He's also been very critical of the whole, you know, fresh charge on the independence of the Reserve Bank, and he gets crucified for it. And I think that's the issue, that, you know, you don't know who you should be listening to. So, you know, our delegation goes off to Davos, but the question is, you know, how much credibility is there for Team Davos when you know, the party is lambasting the finance minister for having what we believe to be a very sensible opinion?
Graham Kerner with the Kerner Perspective on a Thursday night.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702 for the curious.
So what are you going to do with the cash windfall that you will get next month as a result of the cut in interest rates? Is it enough to help you simply pull yourself back from the brink and survive? Is it something that you're going to reinvest in your bond? Is it money that you're going to go, oh, goody, I've got an extra bit of cash, I can now go to the movies? What are you going to do with that money? For many people, they simply say, oh, good, my monthly repayment has dropped, and the cash that they get in their bank accounts simply fritters away and disappears into the sand, never to be seen again. And you don't have a noticeable positive impact on your lifestyle. You don't suddenly change the way you act and behave. You don't go 3 extra meals out on a month. You simply, the money kind of just disappears. And it goes into this sort of household fiscus, if you like. Maya Fisher-French, we've got her to come and tell us just how much you will be saving and how much lower your obligated monthly repayments will be on your bond and what you should be doing with that money. Maya Fisher-French is a personal finance journalist at mayaonmoney.co.za. She joins us on the line this evening. Maya, how much less are we going to be paying our banks for the privilege of them lending money to us, courtesy of this little interest rate cut that we got today?
You know, Bruce, I suppose it depends how much you're borrowing from the bank.
Well, we do a cost per million, or is that too much?
Cost per million. So I think what's really important here is to understand how a little bit makes a lot of money over time. So I actually did, of course, you pull out the calculator straight away on the mortgages, because your mortgage is probably the one that is going to have the biggest upkick for you. So on a R1 million mortgage over 20 years here, you will save, and it doesn't sound like a lot, it's R165 a month. So you could, of course, go out for dinner. I don't know where we can go out for dinner anymore for two people for R165. But yeah, you could go out to dinner again another time during the month. Or what you could do is you could phone your bank now and say to them, I want you to keep my installment exactly the same. Don't drop it by the R165. And that'll actually knock off a whole year off your repayment and save you about over R76,000. So I think that is a far better use than dinner.
You need, absolutely, because, and that's what I said, the money is frittered away, it disappears into the sand. You need to go through that number again, because a lot of people are going to say, Maya, you're talking absolute rubbish. A difference of R165 a month is enough over a 20-year period of a mortgage to knock a full year off the term of that mortgage. So instead of paying it off over 20 years, you pay it off over 19 years, and because you're not paying for that extra year, you spend how much less?
Over R76,000. And I know this is correct because I use the bank calculator to do it, not my own. And I think, you know, Bruce, I think that's the thing always when it comes to interest. People just don't realize what that interest is actually costing over a period of time. You know, we say, oh, well, on R1 million, I'm paying, I think it's 9,650. It'll go down to 9,485, assuming you're paying prime. You know, you see it like that. But when you start to realize what that is actually costing you over 20 years, it gets quite terrifying. So I think that is, to me, really, really powerful. We'd all say we don't have money to save. Well, here you go. You don't even have to save. You just have to make a phone call.
It's critical, and it's a good one. And if you do it after hours, it might be cheaper. Or use your free minutes and you're part of your contract on your cell phone. It won't cost you a cent to make the call. But we've also forget that we did get an interest rate cut last year. I forget exactly when it was. And then you saved yourself R176 on that per million to get the rate from 10.25 down to 10. And now it's gone to 9.75. So if you suddenly look at it and you go, 176 plus 165, and I'll do the calculation for you here, that's a R341 a month per million saving over the last 12 months. That suddenly goes, hold on a second, if you had made that call at when the rates went from 10.25 to 10, and you make the call again today, suddenly you're saving R341 a month on your bond repayment. Suddenly your bond is going from, you know, 20 down to 18 years, and you're saving not R76,000, but probably R150,000. And so one's got to look at this cumulatively as well, and you need to accumulate any sort of gains that you get in this process, surely, Maya?
Absolutely. And you know, if we see another cut, you know, let's be hopeful, and you just do it again, suddenly you find out you've knocked off another year. So you could be now down 3 years. And I think, and it's really, really important to just take those little wins as we get them. And all it does really is take a little bit of action. And, you know, as I said, let's be honest, R165 extra into your pocket right now, probably not going to change the world. You know, R76,000 a year less off your mortgage, that's significant.
It is. And I mean, you know, let's add an extra 25 basis points, because we're bound to get it in the first half of this year. Suddenly, year on year, that's a R500 a month saving per R1 million of your bond. That is, that your bond is now down to 17 years, not 20 years. And the savings are huge.
Yeah. The savings are £200,000. I've done a quick calculation whilst you were talking. So it's £200,000, and you knock off over 3 years. Yeah, well over 3 years. So £200,000 saving for just making sure that you pay the same instalment every time there's a rate decrease.
And the mathematics of this is quite complicated, but it is all about the power of compounding. The one lesson that doesn't get taught often enough in schools is the power of compounding. If you make a little bit of interest, and then you add interest upon your interest upon your interest upon your interest, you make a lot more money over a longer period of time than simply leaving money in the bank and taking the interest out of it. In the same way, when compound interest works against you, as it does with a bond that you don't pay down fast enough, you find that it works against you and devours your capital.
Well, I think what's important, Bruce, when you're paying off your mortgage, is that you always pay the interest, right? So when you get that statement, you get this huge amount that's...
And she's gone. Okay, thank you, Maya Fisher-French, personal finance journalist at Maya on Money. She was there one moment and gone the next, but it's okay, Tikiso. I think we're done with Maya Fisher-French. She is the personal finance writer at mayaonmoney.co.za. She will have the calculations up. She will ensure that you kept informed. But yeah, we've thrown lots of numbers at you in the last 5 minutes or so, but essentially what we're saying to you is that you can knock a year off your mortgage by simply not... by keeping the payment on your bond steady on last month. So whatever you paid in December, you phone up the bank and you say, please make sure that in January I pay exactly the same. And in February I do exactly the same. And when interest rates are cut again, you say to phone them up again and you say, make sure I keep paying the same, please. And if you keep doing that, you get compound interest working in your favor rather than against you. And when you get it working in your favor, over the long term, you save yourself a small, absolute fortune.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that gives your business access to a corridor of possibilities. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
Well, one of the most widely read stories on South Africa's internet today from Michael Jordaan, an opinion piece, the financier and shareholder in South African startups. Michael Jordaan talking about South Africa's obsession with the matric pass rate. And he starts by saying every January, the Department of Basic Education publishes matric results for the prior year. The main focus on the overall pass rate for 2019, the pass rate was a record 81.3%. But that's highly misleading, as only half of the million kids who entered the schooling system 12 years ago even got to write matric exams. It means the true pass rate is actually 40.7%. And it's an inconvenient truth, Michael Jordaan. Government likes to, maintain and claim that it's making these huge inroads and huge successes in education. But every year, we're failing more and more young people who are going through our schooling system.
Good evening, Bruce. It's very sad. I'm positive about South Africa. I'm optimist just by my general nature. But there are a couple of things we have to fix in the country. The one is power. If we don't fix Eskom, there will be no economy. And the other one is human resources. And it is really sad that after so many years of a democracy, we simply haven't gotten to the basics of the education system. So I'm very happy for those students who passed. But unfortunately, it seems that very few of them have passed with the right type of subjects that are needed for the future.
I mean, and being somebody who is focusing heavily on technology-driven companies, many of the investments that you make are into companies where people are using tech to solve problems, whether that be RAIN in terms of internet service provision, whether it be the long-awaited Bank Zero or other investments that you make. It's people who are good at problem-solving, people who do maths and science. And we've got a minuscule number of maths and science matriculants every year.
Yes, Bruce, I actually put that in the article. Last year, the amount of pupils who passed maths when you use a pass rate of 40%. 40% is low because other countries are at 50 or 60%. But at 40%, we passed 77,000 pupils. So that's 7.7% of the initial intake. One in 13 kids who start school will end up passing maths and matric when you use a 40% pass rate. That is shocking. And I juxtapose that with some of the figures in the rest of the world. Now, obviously, China is much bigger, but they graduate 4.3 million engineers every year. So we struggle to get 77,000 kids who pass maths at 40%, while some of our global competitors are graduating 4.3 million engineers. And you're quite right. These are the people that create, and they create the new technology that are taking over the world, everything from artificial intelligence to machine learning to everything that's happening in medicine and in nearly every profession that you can think of, whether you're building rockets or electric cars or harnessing solar, you need those hard skills. So I bemoan the fact that our education system is so incredibly bad, one in 13 kids, when it comes to these hard skills. Sadly, it doesn't stop there because then you need a whole lot of other skills, which I don't think our education system solves for at all. It's initiative. It's the fact that you need to do complex problem solving. It's that the fact that you need teamwork, that you need to have entrepreneurial thinking. So I suppose it's all very daunting, but that doesn't mean that people who don't have the right attitude can't do something about it.
But that's the point, though, Michael. I mean, if you're worried about the quality of education your kids are getting, and yes, they're getting the basics, you know, being taught to read, being taught to reason, you hope, and being taught to understand problem solving, and if your kids are smart, they will make the best of the education system. We need to be then adding the problem-solving skills at home and teaching our kids those problems, because I'm not sure that every education system in the world, in fact, does it adequately for a future that we can't yet fully understand.
I think that's spot on, Bruce. Is we can't just outsource this thing to the public education system out there. Parents have to get heavily involved. And what we're talking about here isn't seeing that they do their homework or, you know, pack their bookcases. It's making sure that do your kids, do they work as a team? It's when they ask you a question to explain it properly to them, and the next day to ask them if they've remembered it, to incentivize them when they do something well, and to disincentivize them when, you know, take away the Wi-Fi when, you know, the behavior is not the way that it should be. I'll give you a very simple thing. Is I find even the people who work incredibly hard at getting the hard skills right, to be good at maths or accounting, whatever it is in work, sometimes aren't helpful. And I think to be helpful is actually so easy. So they work so hard at getting the hard skills right, but a little bit of kindness, a little bit of helpfulness will do very well in your career. So you are completely right that, you know, education, the formal education, that's a small part of what makes individuals successful in life. And we as parents and we as a community need to focus on all the other soft skills on top of those hard skills as well.
Is there any substitute for curiosity? I mean, I don't know how you teach curiosity, but curiosity has got to be the education silver bullet, wanting kids to know more so that they go and they empower themselves because they want to, not because they're forced to, because otherwise they're going to find some detention or whatever kids get nowadays if they don't tick a box at school.
I think curiosity is everything. I mean, the very fact that you ask the question, that is curiosity that makes you ask the question. I think people are inherently curious. I think maybe the fact that a lot of the topic matter is taught in such a boring fashion kind of gets that out of them. But people want to know things. There's this incredible book by Richard Feynman titled The Pleasure of Finding Things Out, which incidentally is bad English because you must never end a sentence in a preposition. But that aside, if you have true pleasure in finding things out, and it can be anything, it can be how bees make honey or how clouds are formed or, you know, why is the sky blue? And that, I think, should be the fundamental task of parents and educators, is to create curiosity and to do it in an entertaining way. There's no reason why, you know, imparting knowledge needs to be boring. You know, if you can create, if you can light that candle of curiosity, I think your work is half done.
The book is what, Richard Feynman, The Pleasure of Finding Things Out.
Yes, he was one of those famous mathematicians. It's a small little book, but that describes his life. And look, I'm a bit of a nerd or a geek, and I realize that describes me as well. You know, if somebody describes any topic to me in a passionate, animated way, it can be very, very interesting, and I just love finding things out. And as you know, the older you get, the more you know how little you know about everything. So that is maybe my other words of advice, if I may. Don't think that just because you've got a 3 or 4 or 5 year degree at university that you've been educated. Nowadays, things are changing so fast that you have to embrace a lifelong journey of learning. And you can only really do that if you have pleasure in learning new stuff every day.
I love the way you put it in the piece that you wrote, which has been so widely read today, but you say, you know, most of what you learned when you were at university and you graduated and you got your PhD either isn't relevant or isn't true anymore. And that's the brutal reality. I mean, if you're not refreshing your knowledge constantly, you become irrelevant as somebody who can positively contribute to society.
You know, so much of what we did learn at school and at varsity, you know, those facts you can now go and look up in Google. So the memorization really isn't worthwhile. It's maybe the discipline that helps, and it's learning how to learn, which is quite an important thing. And that you can continue forever. There's so much that you can read. I mean, I love reading books, but there's so much content available on the internet. So learning to learn is important, and then learning to unlearn. Because sometimes we learn things and we think that they are the truths, and because we learned them 30 years ago, you know, those laws will forever apply. Now, in economics, for example, things have changed quite radically. In medicine, you know, a doctor today can learn things that are completely, completely impractical in 20 years' time, when we will have advanced science on the DNA of bioengineering and the way that people will be treated will be completely personalized and have nothing to do with the way that that doctors study today. So the point is, stay curious, stay hungry, understand that you know very little. In the software world, Mark Andreessen said you must have strong convictions weakly held. So whenever somebody comes to you with new facts, be prepared to change your mind. And that's be prepared to unlearn certain things. Don't always believe all your assumptions. If somebody comes up with new facts, be prepared to change your mind. That works in the investment world, but I think it also works in the world of education in which we live. There are very few absolute truths. Be prepared to learn more and change your mind. My final word on this is if you really want a practical tip, it simply is reading. People who don't read, they've got exactly the same knowledge base as people who can't read. So I've never met anyone who's smart who doesn't read often.
What a lovely way to put it. Michael Jordan, thank you very much indeed. Michael Jordan is a banker, Bank Zero, coming later on this year. He's also in the internet business, but it was also funded by 25 companies, and most of those in the sphere of technology. Bright people with great ideas, problem solvers. Those are the people he's backed. And he's also a deep thinker on how to solve South Africa's problems. Really good article today on how you can address South Africa's education problems without going box ticking and ego trips and fanfares. Yeah, it's great to get a wonderful matric and to get 9 distinctions. That's wonderful. Does that make you a useful member of society? Maybe it does. But for the vast majority of young people who start school, they don't get the accolades. They don't get the opportunities. We've got to think differently about this problem of education. Curiosity at the core.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show is proudly brought to you by APSA Corporate and Investment Banking, winner of the 2019 Bonds, Loans and Sukuk Award for Corporate Debt Deal of the Year. That's Africanacity. APSA is a registered FSP. Good evening and welcome to The Money Show. No official clarity on SAA and its future. A key deadline looming this weekend. We did hear from Dono Mohajani, who is the Director General at National Treasury, that he has been in meetings all day today discussing the possibility of pulling together the 2 billion rand the government committed it would contribute to the process of business rescue. Government's got no desire to let this thing go to the wall. There's been some suggestion that perhaps SAA, now out of its hands and in the hands of a business rescue practitioner, is easier to let fail. But I think that's a bit cynical. Government doesn't want it to fail because it will come back to it and bite it in the backside. There's 6,000 people who work at SAA, too many, and the business rescue practitioner is going to have to go through a process of rationalizing that workforce in order to ensure that the very best of the best at SAA, and there's some phenomenal people who work within that organization who've been let down by multiple managers and multiple boards over a decade. They've been betrayed, as the rest of us have, by gross incompetence and, in many cases, blatant dishonesty, fraud and corruption. I mean, it's been wholesale theft in many cases out of SAA. But we've got to get some sort of solution for this, for the airline, which has announced today officially that it's put some of its aircraft up for sale to accommodate what it says will be the new Airbus A350-900s, which the airline is adding to its fleet. These are the, instead of having the massive 4-engine gas guzzlers, these are the more efficient, quieter 2-engine aircraft. And so they're getting rid of some of the dead wood, some of the old tech that has contributed to its economic woes, because these things take half an oil field in order to get airborne. And so they're doing the right sort of stuff, but geez, they're doing it in really, really difficult circumstances. I suspect that tomorrow we'll get an announcement from National Treasury that somebody went and found all the piggy banks hidden in government departments, rattled them, took the cash out, and suddenly 2 billion rand has materialized, and SAA will survive to fly another day or two or three. But yeah, it's on tenterhooks, certainly, the business rescue practitioner. It'd be good to get him, Tikiso Lefifi. It'd be good to get the business rescue practitioner so we can better understand the process here on The Money Show.
702. Bruce is on The Money Show.
Well, like everything, investing does cost money. I think we accept that it must cost something. But the biggest problem with investing is that unless you're either adept at using a slide rule or you're some kind of magician, it's really hard to, one, calculate the cost of your investments, and even more complicated, to understand the long-term impact of those costs on your capital. If you manage to save investment costs today, and instead of paying those to a service provider, you invest that money and that money grows and compounds over time, the huge impact over 20 and 30 years is quite considerable. Go to any investment calculator online, and there are plenty of free ones available, and you'll quickly see the impact of whether you're paying 1% or 2% or 3% or 4% of your investments away in costs, how that just devours your returns over time. We'll chat to Warren Ingram in a moment about this, but first let's chat to the head of Outvest, Grant Locke. You sent me an email last week saying that you were listening to Khan Morby of the Parlor Tones, who was one of our Make Money Mondays guests last year, and something he said about the investment industry and the way fees are structured and calculated and disclosed really got to you, Grant.
Yeah, hi Bruce, and hi to your listeners, and thanks for having us on the show. And I can remember listening in the car to your discussion with Khan Morby, and I, you know, when you said, you know, the statements about how fees are so difficult to understand and how, you know, the industry makes it very, very difficult, and using a percentage-based fee is just, it's just not something we use in our daily lives. And, you know, I was actually wanted to get out of the car there and phone you and say, hey, listen, we're working on this thing, just wait for it. But it took another 8 months until we can get this thing live. And, you know, we've just launched this thing in December now, and we call it the Outvest One Fee. And really the idea is to actually be as revolutionary.
Before we get to the revolution, I mean, people may be perturbed as to why I'm saying, you know, we're listening to Khan Morby, and Khan Morby says that fees are one of the biggest cons on earth. Why would I care what a musician thinks of fees? Well, the fact is that he used to work as a financial advisor in a bank, and that's where he had his epiphany, just so that we've got Khan Morby in context for those of you who either missed the interview or forgotten it. But yes, so what you've done now, you've launched a flat fee on investments. Take me through how it works.
Well, yeah, in fact, that's exactly what it is. And I think the most important thing about it, first, two things to understand about fees first is that, you know, when you use a percentage-based fee, it's very difficult for anybody to understand what the investment costs. Because we all work in rands and cents for cell phone contracts and, you know, anything we do, we sort of think in rands and cents. And using a percentage-based fee, something like 3% doesn't sound like a lot of money. But over 30 or 40 years, it's actually an incredibly vast amount of money. And that takes away from your return. And the second aspect is that in the investment services industry, in the administration of your investment, not all the fees are taken in one place. So you never see all of your fees always on one statement, in one charge. And I think putting those two things together is really the problems we were trying to solve. So what we've done then is we actually approached it from a different angle and said, well, what does it really cost to run a full investment service? An investment service that includes advice and administration, all the things that you need to be able to get you to your outcome. And in our mind, that any investment from 300,000 Rand upwards until 2.25 million, you're going to be paying 4,500 Rand a year. And to a lot of people, that sounds like a hell of a lot of money, until you realize that a 3% fee on something like 100,000 Rand is 30,000 Rand a year for the same service. So I think, you know, we actually are genuinely changing the conversation to say, hey, listen, what does it actually cost you? And if you sort of stay in that percentage fee world, you know, just because you sort of, every time you add money to your investment, every time your investment grows, when you use a percentage-based fee, you pay more in fees. And when you use a fixed fee, one that increases by inflation every year, you completely change those dynamics entirely. More of the growth and contributions goes back to the client's returns.
But somebody who's investing 300,000 is going to say, this is unfair. Why must I pay the same as somebody who's invested 2.25 million? Why must we both pay 4,400 Rand? I deserve more of a kickback because I have less. I want you to charge me less. Or the person investing more saying, I'm entrusting you with more of my money. I want an even better rate.
And that's a fantastic argument. It's been going on for absolute years. You know, yeah. Let's look after those people. You know, let's tell them that, you know, when you invest more money, you're so much more important. But in a business like ours, we run a digitized robo-advisor with human advisors in the process. We have a service level that we give all our clients. So why should we charge people with a lot more money for the same service that we'll give to someone who doesn't have that much money? And I think that's the cost, right? What do you pay for what you get? That's the value discussion. And every single month when you look on your statement and you see a fee comes out, that fee is related, you pay nothing else for your investment. And I think that's really the revolution. We're trying to change the thinking about this. Yeah, percentage-based fees for anyone who has less than 300,000 Rand will just charge you 1.5% because we're trying to attract people in and get them to grow their investments for the long term. But I think that's the fundamental key here.
Why will you charge somebody who has less than 300,000 Rand more than somebody who has 300,000 Rand if the service levels are exactly the same? Please clarify that one for me, because you're saying that you'll charge somebody who's 2.25 or 300,000 exactly the same. Why you discriminate against those with less than 300,000, the guys who are so desperately trying to get to your magical...
No, we're actually going to charge them less.
Okay.
So 1.5% of anything less than 300,000 Rand is less than 4,500 Rand a year.
Oh, right. Okay. Fair enough. Okay. And I get the logic of the calculation. When it comes to doing this, you've got to then do some very, very big volumes of business in order to justify the fact that you're not charging what the investment industry traditionally charges.
There's two ways to do it. Yes, volume is absolutely important. But the second reason is keeping things simple. Keep your administration simple. Keep your business digital. And by keeping your cost base controlled, you also don't have to attract all these fees to be able to service all of these existing complex arrangements that we don't actually have in our business. When you process an instruction, when you add money or remove money, no human touches that. It goes straight into the core administration system and your instruction is processed. I don't need someone to sit there and check your instruction or sign a piece of paper.
What am I getting for my money, my 4,400 rand a year, assuming I've got 300,000 rand to invest? Am I getting a limited choice of potential investment options? Because it's got to be quite simple, because I don't have somebody to answer my every question. I can ask the bot questions and it'll give me answers, but I might get lost in the process because I don't understand investment jargon or whatever the case might be. So what am I getting? Because also, if you give me very little, I'm then maybe overpaying for what I'm getting.
Absolutely. So what you get from us is you get the funds that we have. Those funds we developed in conjunction with CoreShares. That's included in the cost, the entire portfolio construction, the management of those funds, the transaction costs, the VAT. Everything to do with that investment is covered. You also get all of your administration, all of your tax certificates, all of your reporting. You get access to your an app that you can add or can add or remove money whenever you like. You also get our advice services, which also includes a human advisor. A human advisor who's on call to help you make better investment decisions. So you get the human advisor as well. And then, of course, we've also got an investment tracking system. So when you set a target on our platform and it's coming for RAs now, we will help you stay on track to reach that outcome. And I think that for us is something that no one's really ever discussed before. Is, hey, listen, yes, it's investment. Yes, it's the capital markets. Yes, you can't forecast returns tomorrow. But I still, when I want to get to a particular rand amount, can you help me get there? And that's what our technology does. So I think, in terms of the value that you get for it, you get your product wrapper, you get your investment, you get your administration, you get all of your technology, you get the ease of use, and you get access to a human to help you make decisions.
Warren Ingram, I'm bringing you in here. It sounds too good to be true.
Good evening.
Happy New Year. Nice to see you. Lovely to have you. But cut to the chase. It does sound too good to be true, because the investment industry has told us for many, many years you need to employ lots of very expensive people who think very carefully about things, who spend many years studying and using Pythagoras' theorem and a slide rule and a set square, and they divine the price of shares and therefore can make better decisions than anybody else, and that's what you pay for, and that's why fees are big and obtuse.
Yeah, so there is... I think I almost want to say to you, this is what we would call shots fired. This is real. One of the big criticisms. So let's just talk about the unit trust industry as an example. One of the big criticisms has always been, how much does it cost to run a unit trust company when they're running one unit trust of, let's say, 100 million rand? How much does it cost them to run that fund compared to when that fund grows to 5 billion or 50 billion, because there are lots of, you know, 20, well, not lots, but there are 20, 30, 40 billion rand unit trusts in this country, and they're charging their clients roughly the same percentage, whether that client invests, you know, 1,000 rand or 10 million rand. The percentage is the same. So those become massively profitable things for asset managers to run. And now all of a sudden, you know, Grant and his team have said, okay, well, hang on, we're going to turn this on its head. You're going to pay 4,500 rand. That's it. So that doesn't matter. The cost is the cost, and the scale is going to be subsidized, I guess, because as you said in the beginning, they've got to get more clients. But this is shots fired. I mean, this is, there are lots of questions around this, but I feel about the same as when you asked me to first investigate easy equities. And I had to do my homework here as well and say, well, you know, what's the too good to be true here? What's the catch or what's the angle? I looked hard, because I'm a skeptical sort, and I can't really find it. You know, I don't think there's it's not a scam or there's no crookery here or anything like that. This is a case of saying, you know, let's try and make it simple. I'll give you the criticism now, because obviously I'm not, you know, nothing's perfect. But I don't think that there is a deep concern from someone putting their money in where they need to worry that, you know, it won't come out one day because there was, you know, some kind of crookery or something. There wasn't.
But why should I go this way rather than go into an index tracking fund of some description? And there are hundreds of the blooming things available now. Why should I go this way and not that way?
Yeah, so that's the core thing here, is to understand that a lot of the underlying investments in here are indexed. So that's not that's part of how they managed to keep the costs down. But I think the difference here is that you get almost a safety net. So for someone who says, you know, I kind of want to go and buy my own exchange-traded fund or my own index tracking unit trust, and I don't need a lot of advice from a human advisor, sometimes they still want to know, do I buy the top 40 one, or do I buy the Swix one, or do I buy the, you know, and what my time frames are. And so to have an overlay of advice that attaches to that for the person that still wants to do it themselves, that's where this kicks in, is because it's saying, hang on, you know, you've got a certain time frame, you've got a certain risk, et cetera, et cetera. This is the proper solution for you. And there's a kind of a safety net, is the best way I can describe it. Whereas, you know, someone who's got zero knowledge on investments, I mean, you know, I don't know how many exchange traded funds there are in South Africa now, but there are a lot, and they're increasing all the time. And so for someone with no knowledge, they could easily find themselves in the wrong fund. And I think that's where the kind of help comes in, you know, the advice help comes in.
Yeah, but I, if you don't mind me interrupting, I mean, you're exactly right. That's exactly what it's designed to do. And I think more so is, like, you also get, you know, the sort of the portfolio construction, the design of these particular funds, the governance to make sure they're doing what they should be doing, and all of the advice, all of the investment tracking, all of that stuff, and the access to a human advisor on top of that as well. That's part of it.
Yeah, you can hear he gets excited about the technical stuff at the back there. So
we haven't even talked about stochastic models yet.
Yeah, please don't.
Oh, no, please don't. No, because then we're all going to fall asleep and I snore.
So my concern, well, not concern, my criticism, if I've got one, is that it's not going to solve your whole life's problems in one shot. So in other words, you can't, you know, talk to the machine and say, okay, you know, this is my age and these are like, you know.
I need to retire in 5, 10, 15, 20 years. Solve the problem for me. What do I need to do?
Yeah. So the way this will work is it's going to be a series of individual goals that you give it. So you say, I've got to save for X amount for I've got a goal for my kids' education, or I've got to put down a bond deposit in X time, or whatever the deal is. So it's a series of individual goals that you need to specify and then save for. And that in this instance, this is a good tool, and that's really what it is. It's a tool that gives you the outcome as well. So it's a package of things that will get you to that. But it's not, if you sit down and say, you know, I want everything packaged nicely for me, that will just, you know, one thing solves all my problems in one without me having to do individual goal setting, and that doesn't work like that. So I think that's maybe, you know, I obviously have to try and find a reason why I'm still going to have a job tomorrow. And that's probably part of the deal here, is that I think, you know, people who want to kind of sit in front of an advisor who says, okay, let's understand your whole picture, let's understand who you are, you know, what you were like as a child when it came to money, and what you were like, you know, what was money like when you were growing up, and how do we get you through the bad times, et cetera, et cetera, and let's put a whole package of solutions together for you that suit all of your needs. That's what an advisor will do. And frankly, there is no technology tool that can do that. Thank goodness.
How How are we going to measure, Warren, the performance of Outvest's offerings versus the rest of the investment industry? Because, I mean, the whole very long and boring debate that's been going on for 20 years, because I think ETFs, exchange-traded funds, have been around for 20 years, has seen, you know, every time you open your mouth and talk about ETFs versus active management, you end up in a mad fight about value versus perceived value versus returns versus, oh, my goodness me, and it then ends up in a different debate altogether. How do we know that we're getting a good deal, not only because we're paying less, but actually we're getting market performance as well?
Yeah, so I think probably two parts. One is, you know, the solutions themselves, the actual investment solutions are unit trusts. So those are things that get reported and the performance is tracked and monitored, you know, and you can actually just, you know, go to one place and check every single unit trust in South Africa. So it's quite easy actually to see how the...
What is that one place called? It used to be called equinox.co.za and then somebody else bought it, I think PSG bought it. Well, what is it now?
I use one called Morningstar. You know, I mean, so there are lots of them, Bruce. It's not just one. I don't know which one's free for. I think you know, a couple of the financial websites offer that tool where you can go and see the performance. Let's not give those financial websites free advertising, but there are those. And so it's a case of saying, well, we can see what the solution has delivered for people, and then you know adding 4,500 rand a year to that.
Now, you started off by saying shots fired, Warren, shots fired, because the investment industry, when Jack Bogle was at the Omaha gathering with Warren Buffett, and Warren Buffett, Jack Bogle was turning 90, and he died last year, of course, but Jack Bogle was told, you know, you're a superhero, you've saved American investors billions of dollars in fees, because he introduced index funds into the United States, and they've become very popular there. When we look at this index environment, it's such an exciting environment in terms of investment opportunity.
Absolutely, and I think so this is one, you know, this is a case of I mean, a new business coming into the industry, looking at the problems and saying, well, we've got no legacy that we have to defend. So it's not like they've got a, you know, 100 billion rand business where you know, lots of people are going to be out of a job if they change their fee structure. They are not starting 100% from zero, but they're starting, you know, close to zero and building a business. So they can take the chance, because that's what it is. It is a big chance to try something completely different and hope that they gather the assets. But I think what it is going to do, like exchange traded funds did both in the US and then eventually in South Africa, is it forces the incumbents, the big players in this industry, to look at their fees, and suddenly, you know, their own clients are going to be looking at them and saying, hang on, you know, why is it that I can pay those guys in total like 4,500 a year, and I have to pay you, when I add up all my fees on my calculator and my spreadsheet, that it's going to be 500,000-600,000 rand or whatever the deal is? Why? What's the value proposition here? And I think that's where it's going to force the industry to look at this. Obviously, my part of the industry, the advice industry, is going to look at this very carefully, because, you know, if you're a bank broker, you know, an advisor working for a bank or an insurance broker selling product, and suddenly this comes along, you know, the advice here is probably at least as good, probably that's underselling it, probably better than your average bank broker or insurance agent, you know, starting out definitely. And the rand costs are known, so it is shots fired. It's shots fired right across the spectrum.
Do you intend, Grant Lock, to be South Africa's Jack Bogle? Do you see this as an opportunity to actually really reshape the way in which the investment industry treats its clients?
You know, like, I don't think I could ever credit myself with the kind of thing that someone like Jack did, but I think the one thing we are doing and we care about is just getting people to their outcomes, making investment more important in the lives of people out there. And I think there's a massive advice gap out there. There are so many people that would like to make better investment decisions, better financial decisions. So the idea behind this is education's one way of doing it. You know, you can create all this amazing education. But for us, what we're trying to do with Outvest is create a great investing experience. And we actually had a stat the other day. I was actually talking to Warren about it before we got here. You know, we're actually starting to track the people who get to their outcomes using our platform, because we know exactly every contribution you were going to make. We know what your target is. We know what you're trying to do on the platform. And our cash flow engines, our modeling systems, know what you're invested in. They know how long you're invested for. And so we're now starting to get a database of people who've now passed their targets. Did they achieve them? Did they not? What did they do when they didn't get them? And that kind of thing, that kind of financial information, that kind of mass customization is really where we want to go.
Thanks to Grant Locke, the head of Outvest, and also to Warren Ingram. He is a director, personal financial advisor at Galileo Capital. Getting a real insight this evening as to perhaps, and we hope, a price war in the world of investing. And if you can understand the way what your investments really cost, then you're a better person than most of us, because there are so many fees and there's so many layers of fees. And the thing, you know, you see something on your statement says total expense ratio. It's a total expenses of the fees that you see on that page. It doesn't include your financial advisor. It doesn't include other fees that you might be charged as well. So this is, seriously, a shake-up for South Africa's investment industry.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that gives your business access to a corridor of possibilities. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. The Money Show. Small business.
There are two types of people in the world. There are those that see the cloud with a silver lining. There are those that see a silver lining and see a cloud. What mood are you in as we kick off 2020? Pavlo Fatidis from Auric Business Accelerator. More cloudy or more liney?
You know, Bruce, it's both. It's both at the same time. Because when is enough enough? Because it feels to me that it's enough now. Promises were made, and those promises have been broken, and we've been waiting for 2 years. We've been waiting for Eskom to come right. We've been waiting for prosecutions to take place. We've been waiting for investment to come into the country. We've been waiting to get certainty around a spate of things. And yet, where are we at the beginning of 2020? We're still in the same place that we were when these promises were made. It's enough now. It's enough. And most people I'm speaking to are finding the frustration of knowing and understanding how to deal with this incredibly difficult. But there is a way, you see.
No, but yeah, I mean, I'm getting a sense of people who are really, really angry. And they're angry to the point of capitulation. They're angry to the point of giving up on the country. They're angry to the point of giving up on their businesses. They're just generally going, you know what, if I cash in today and sell everything, and if I can find somebody to buy it from me, and I can then take an early retirement, because, you know, I just don't want to be pushing a greasy rock up a treacherous slope anymore. And that's what South Africa feels like. And people are just, what's the word? The murin, I think, is probably the correct term.
I think you're right. And it's across the board. It's people who are job seeking. It's people who are quite successfully employed in businesses. It's certainly happening extensively in amongst the world of SMEs. The private business owner is feeling it on a level that I'm yet to see, or I've yet to have witnessed and experienced myself. And it's quite hard remaining positive, quite frankly. And a large part of what quells the positivity that you need in order to build a business, Bruce, is understanding how to cope with your anger. Because how do you fight a government if it's a government that you blame and hold accountable for the state of our economy? You know, I look at the debacle with Eskom, and it's continuing. And yet, if you follow some of the insights, some of the opinions of people who are experts in the sector, I follow Chris Yelland. I read a lot of his content that he releases, because he has truly, truly committed his life to this particular sector and he understands it intimately. The solutions are simply a signature way. And yet, because of conflicted agendas, conflicted ideologies that have very little to do with fixing an energy provider in the country, we can't seem to get these things passed. And now we sit again with a new chairperson who I know from nothing at all. But what I do know is not a person with deep expertise in power generation. And the example that I keep on drawing on, you know, if you look at the most successful airlines in the world, and that's a tough, tough, tough business to get right. It's Emirates, Qantas, and Cathay Pacific. So those three are considered to be the best performing airlines in the world. What's interesting about them, Bruce, is that the CEOs of those businesses, none of them are nationals of the countries that the airlines represent. So they're all foreign. All of them have got deep, long histories of technical and commercial expertise within the airline industry. their expertise has been proven because there's evidence to demonstrate the impact that they've had. And they've been brought in to run very, very complicated businesses. So in effect, those three airlines, or let's call it those three countries, turned around and said, who is the best in the world that's out there? And how do we gain and lever their expertise in order to become the best in the world? And I don't understand why we simply don't follow a similar path, because we have got so much locked in potential that's trapped and stuck in ideologies and in arguments that really have yielded nothing so far, policies that seem never to be implemented, and a complete inability for people to take real action and turn talk into walk.
What is the purpose then of getting cross about it? Because this stuff is beyond your and my ability to deal with. Yes, we get a chance every 5 years to go and put a little cross on a piece of paper and we express a political view. And then we go home and we end up shouting for the next 5 years and having massive debates and massive arguments with everybody who will listen as to the state of the country and what a mess it is. And then 5 years later, we go back and we make a cross. It may be against the next to the name of the party that we voted for last time, or, you know, if we're bright, it's not. And we go through, we make our choices. Yet, so much of the stuff is beyond our control. So is there a purpose, a value in the rage, in the anger? It feels like such a wasted emotion.
Well, it's a wasted emotion if it's not addressed, because to not be angry at the moment in this country, well, you must be quite remarkable. You must be quite remarkable, because I don't know one part of society that hasn't been let down. Whether you are unemployed, whether you're employed, whether you're in business, whether you're not in business, whatever the situation is, I'm finding it very, very hard to find any part of society other than certain politicians in certain political parties that think that things are fine and things are acceptable. If you don't get angry, you can't act, because the anger's there in any event, Bruce. If you suppress anger, anger turns on you. It makes you cynical, and cynicism has built nothing. Skepticism is a very healthy emotion, and it's a very healthy place for your mind to be all the time. But cynicism shrinks everything in your world, in your life, in your purview. It makes you negative, it narrows your vision, and it turns you into someone who will never really move, act, or achieve other than simply blame and continue to blame. We have such a short life, and is that how you want to spend your life? And I think it's a question that we should be asking, because we've been in this morass for some time now, and this malaise is simply not moving on. So the anger is there. The other part of the anger is if you harness it and you say, right, it's there. I'm going to bring it out. I'm going to express it, because enough is enough, but I'm going to turn it into positive energy and point it in a positive direction. If you can harness that energy, that angry energy, because it has a tremendous amount of power behind it, that's where I have seen businesses built that have changed the world. So the potential is there. If you don't use it, I think you're missing out on an opportunity. If you suppress it, I think you're going to make yourself sick and you're going to waste your life, quite honestly.
Sure. Pablo Fatidis, you had a good holiday. Pablo Fatidis is the managing director, the founder of Auric Business Accelerator. It's channeling your anger to be more productive. And frankly, when I look at South Africa today, I see problem after problem after problem. I see lots of difficulty. I see lots of crises. I see lots of people who are desperate for help on multiple fronts. That then does something else. It brings to the fore the ability for people who are opportunistically minded to seize those opportunities and to create businesses that solve the problems of the future, the problems that we don't even see yet, the problems that exist each and every single day. For every problem that is created in a society, hopefully we've got a person who's got a solution to address that problem. Maybe that's where you take your anger and you say, I am fed up with this set of circumstances. Okay, how do we go about, you can't fix them, but how do you go about alleviating them, addressing them, challenging them, creating a business that makes other people's lives easier? Maybe that's where we need to go. With Pablo, in a bit.
The Money Show.
Small business.
Pablo Fatidis from Auric Business Accelerator, channeling his rage this evening, the broken promises, the failures to address fairly simple issues as a state, and South Africans are being let down across society. So what do? You either, I mean, I don't mean to oversimplify it here, Pavlo, but there are two choices. You either give up, or you go, hold on a second, they're in the mess, there is opportunity. And frankly, giving up is for losers, to quote a guy who, you know, is akin to Agent Orange.
Yeah, completely. And, you know, the purpose... So look, Bruce, the most productive way to use your time is to fight for something. When you build a business, you're fighting for something. You're either fighting for market share, you're fighting to introduce a new product or a new service into the market, you're fighting to get access to information, you're fighting to get access to money, you're fighting to get the right talent on board, you're fighting to harness and control the growth and the expansion of your business. But it is about fighting. And fighting is remarkable because when you fight, you feel alive. But there are a couple of different ways to fight. When you're fighting something far bigger than you, which this is, because how do you fight a government? How do you fight government policies? How do you fight broken promises? When, as you rightly say, the only mechanism you truly, truly have is a vote, one single vote, once every so often, that has mostly proved to be quite ineffectual, in a better way, put simply. So you have to fight. And when you step into a ring, and you step into a ring with a formidable foe in front of you, you have your three choices. You have the opportunity to give up immediately there and then, and that's where you allow the anger to consume you. You allow the anger to drive you down. You get to a place where you're so cynical, you're so frustrated, you feel so voiceless, you feel so unable to do things that you just simply resign yourself and become despondent. And I spoke with a really very, very successful property developer this morning. And he's a gentleman. He's well into his 60s, I think. And he turned around and he said, for the first time in my life, here I am with all this knowledge, all this know-how, a remarkable track record behind me, and I feel completely despondent. We can't afford to allow someone like that who has that capability, that potential, that skill set to be in that position. That individual has to get his head right and start doing what he does best. Because when you fight to make something happen, it brings in your talent, it brings in your energy, it makes you alive again. So if you harness that energy, if you harness the energy of anger and say, this is not good enough, I am going to fight, then you need to fight smart to build your business. And I'll give you a way that you can fight. If we take a very particular example to put this into good use, and let's keep on the subject of Eskom, because it is it's like a wet blanket that lies over this nation. And a wet blanket is never ever comfortable. It lies over the nation and it remains there. So imagine that somewhere in South Africa, there is an industrial estate. The industrial estate is suffering from extensive, let's call it cable theft, that has not yet been resolved, and yet there are technologies to resolve it. It's suffering from the ongoing spate of blackouts that have not yet been resolved, and it seems as if they're going to continue into the future too. And yet they have been disempowered from generating their own electricity because of certain provisions and regulations. But let's say they chose to fight. And these businesses came together and said, if we don't get this right, we ourselves will suffer. We need to get off the grid. And in doing so, they create a plant of some sort that moves up to 10 megawatts or whatever the case might be. It doesn't generate or use the grid whatsoever. And it contravenes a piece of regulation that's holding back the investment in independent power producers moving from the 1 megawatt to the 10 megawatt plant. Now, they've broken the law in many ways because they, in fighting, are trying to fight for a different position. If they get sued by government, if they get sued by Eskom for having broken the law in that manner, Bruce, where do you think it would leave everybody? Because that fight would then spur action, and that fight would then start to highlight the plight of businesses out there. That is a positive way to direct your energy because it forces the issue onto the table and says the time has now come. We either close down these businesses or we build our own independent capability to drive our businesses, grow our businesses, and do what business should be doing, which is paying taxes, creating employment, and growing.
I agree completely, but very few people, entrepreneurs, are activists. I mean, you're telling people that they have to become activists in order to survive, and they go, hold on a second, but I'm busy, I'm trying to build a business.
So let me give you the business opportunity, Bruce.
I don't have time to be an activist.
No, you don't have to be an activist. If you do this, every single media station will be talking about what you have gone and done. It's the best possible way to promote your brand and your position and your business within South Africa. So you can look at it, again, with a positive opportunity, the silver cloud that you spoke about, or the silver lining you spoke about. Because if that fight were to take place, and it's simply a hypothesized example, you know, I don't know if anyone has the will to do this or the interest to do this, but if it were to take place, who would the public defend? Because this is a fight that should take place within the broad-based media environment. Let everyone know that the fight is taking place. That would be the strategy. That would be the clever opportunity for the business owner. Yes, I agree, you aren't allowed to do it. You should not do it. But if you have to do it in order to survive your business, in order to get your business working again, in order for your business to grow, and your back is against the wall in all other instances, what do? Do you simply throw up the gloves and say, you know what, you're bigger than me, throw your punch, I'll fall with the first blow? Or do you fight to get to the other side of it?
Pavlo Fotidis has gone on holiday and come back as a revolutionary. And frankly, I'm delighted. Pavlo, thank you. Lovely to see you. Welcome back. And Pavlo Fotidis on a Thursday night on The Money Show. Small business is his focus. He's a deeply impassioned proponent of the art of small business. And he's got a brand new book, which is out on the shelves. Keep an eye out for it. Pavlo Fotidis joins us on a Thursday night to talk issues of small business.
702. Bruce is on Twitter at Bruce Business.
That's it from The Money Show on this Thursday evening. Wrapping up the week on the next Money Show, we'll play the Brutal Biz Quiz. We'll cover all the big money stories on the day. And hopefully by this time tomorrow, Donda Mokhajani would have had some time to go and find the money SAA needs in order to stay airborne for another couple of months. But that is all the problem of tomorrow's show. In the meantime, have yourself a very good evening. Good night.